BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Good evening and welcome to the 30th of December Dialect Holiday Special. I'm Jeff Sparks and I'll be bringing you a selection of longer interviews with people we very rarely hear from on the radio or on television. Why? Because they're controversial. This week we have Myron Fagan, Annie Mashin and Nick Colostrum. But we start the show with some music from the Sonics with the track Psycho. That was the Sonics with the track Psycho. Back in the early 1960s, a remarkable series of three long play records were pressed in the USA. They contained the detailed thoughts and predictions of Jewish playwright Myron Fagan. For 2.5 hours, he described a web of deceit that he said he heard about in Hollywood, an oligarchy ruled by a small group of clandestine people behind the scenes, war makers and international financiers, manipulating global events with virtually no press or police scrutiny whatsoever. He called them the Illuminati. In this extract, Myron Fagan describes what he believes is an evil program for three murderous world wars devised hundreds of years ago.
White's plan was as simple as it has proved effective. It called for communism, Nazism, political Zionism, and other international movements be organized and used to foment three global world wars and at least two major revolutions. The First World War was to be fought so as to enable the Illuminati to destroy Tsarism in Russia, as vowed by Rothschild after the Tsar had torpedoed his scheme at the Congress in Vienna, and to transform Russia into a stronghold of atheistic communism. The differences stirred up by agents of the Illuminati between the British and German empires were to be used to foment this war. After the war would be ended, communism was to be built up and used to destroy other governments and weaken religions. World War II, when and if necessary, was to be fomented by using the controversies between fascists and political Zionists. And here let it be noted that Hitler was financed by Krupp, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, and other internationalist bankers, and that the slaughter of the supposed 600,000 Jews by Hitler didn't bother the Jewish internationalist bankers at all. That slaughter was necessary in order to create worldwide hatred of the German people and thus bring about the war against them. In short, this Second World War was to be fought to destroy Nazism and to increase the power of political Zionism so that the State of Israel could be established in Palestine. During this World War II, international communism was to be built up until it equaled in strength that of United Christendom. When it reached that point, it was to be contained and kept in check until required for the final social cataclysm. As we know now, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin put that exact policy into effect, and Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson continued that same exact policy. World War III is to be fomented by using the so-called controversies, the agents of the Illuminati, operating under whatever new name, are now stirring up between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Muslim world. That war is to be directed in such a manner that all of Islam and political Zionism, Israel, will destroy each other, while at the same time, the remaining nations, once more divided on this issue, will be forced to fight themselves into a state of complete exhaustion, physically, mentally, spiritually, and economically. Now, can any thinking person doubt that the intrigue now going on in the near, middle, and far east is designed to accomplish that satanic objective? Pike himself foretold all this in a statement he made to Mazzini on August 15, 1871. Pike stated that after World War III is ended, those who will inspire to undisputed world domination will provoke the greatest social cataclysm the world has ever known. Quoting his own words, taken from the letter he wrote to Mazzini, and which letter is now catalogued in the British Museum in London, England, he said, "We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provoke a great social cataclysm which in all its horror will show clearly to all nations the effect of absolute atheism, the origin of savagery and of most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere, the people forced to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries will exterminate those destroyers of civilization, and the multitudes disillusioned with Christianity, whose deistic spirits will be from that moment on without direction and leadership, and anxious for an ideal but without knowledge where to send its adoration, will receive the true light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought finally out into public view, a manifestation which will result from a general reactionary movement which will follow the destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." When Mazzini died in 1872, Pike made another Italian revolutionary leader named Adrian Lemmy his successor. Lemmy, in turn, was succeeded by Lenin and Trotsky, then by Stalin. The revolutionary activities of all those men were financed by British, French, German, and American international bankers, all of them dominated by the House of Rothschild. We are supposed to believe that the international bankers of today, like the money changers of Christ's day, are only the tools or agents of the great conspiracy. But actually, They are the masterminds behind all of it. While the general public has been brainwashed by all the mass communications media into believing that communism is a movement of the so-called workers, the actual fact is that both British and American intelligence officers have authentic documentary evidence that international liberals operating through their international banking houses, particularly the House of Rothschild, have financed both sides in every war and revolution since 1776. Those who today comprise the conspiracy, the CFR in the United States, direct our governments, whom they hold in usury through such methods as the Federal Reserve System in America, to fight wars such as Vietnam, created by the United Nations, so as to further Pike's Illuminati plans to bring the world to that stage of the conspiracy when atheistic communism and the whole of Christianity can be forced into an all-out Third World War within each remaining nation, as well as on an international scale.
And you can hear the complete 2.5-hour version on the Dialect website. Now we come to some more music, and this is Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros with Arms Aloft.
Sometimes there's no star shining, scouting the edge of the universe. Sometimes you can't see a horizon between the ocean and the earth. Just when you were thinking about slinking down, I'm gonna pull you up, I'm gonna pull you out.
May I remind you of that scene? The spirit is all gasoline. May I remind you of that scene? We were arms aloft in Aberdeen. May I remind you of that scene? The very miracles be.
To be a repetitive strain, just when you thought you're going down the drain.
May I remind you of that scene? The spirit is all gasoline. May I remind you of that scene?
We were arms aloft in Aberdeen.
May I remind you of that scene? The million miracles beam. May I remind you of that scene?
Thank you.
That was Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros with Arms Aloft. Next up we have Idiot 3 with a track titled Feelings. Back in 1997, two MI5 officers, Annie Mashin and David Shaler, decided to blow the whistle. They had come across massive sums of British taxpayers' money which were being paid to terrorists in Libya to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. Although the assassination attempt failed, many innocent people were killed, at British taxpayers' expense. Here's Annie now talking earlier this month when she was on tour in Suffolk.
So, yes, it's a bit of a weird story. In the mid-1990s, I worked as an intelligence officer for MI5. And in 1996, I left with my ex-partner and former colleague, David Shaler. And we blew the whistle in 1997 about a whole catalogue of crimes we saw going wrong on the inside. And these included things like files on all the government ministers, illegal phone taps, innocent people put in prison, bombs going off on British streets that could have been prevented, up to and including an assassination attempt on Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, which was funded by MI6. So it was quite a string of incompetence and also criminality that we felt we had to do something about. In this country, there are huge numbers of files held on people just for their political beliefs. MI5 was incredibly paranoid about the syndrome of Reds under the bed. So if you're involved in any legitimate left-wing activity, the chances were that you had a file. In fact, even if you were just friends who was involved with a group like the Socialist Workers' Party or Militant Tendency or the Communist Party, you would have a file. And this is for holding democratic beliefs, you know, it's just crazy. He wrote into the Communist Party HQ asking for some background information and then ended up with a file. And while that's sort of slightly wry, sort of amusing, in an amusing sort of way as well, it also has serious implications, because if that young man grew up and wanted to go and work for the civil service or whatever, he would be banned from doing that, which as we've seen with the Labour government, because most of them, of course, in their fiery youth, had sort of left-wing sympathies and were involved in quite a number of these groups, so they all have files as well. And of course, they're not allowed to see their files, so we have a strong democratic deficit in this country where the spies hold secret information on their political masters, and the political masters jump to their bidding. So you see all these things going wrong, and it gets worse and worse. But it was really the Gaddafi plot that was the final nail in the coffin, where, as I said, MI6 funded al-Qaeda terrorists in Libya to try and assassinate Gaddafi. The attack went wrong, but innocent people died. And the attack was also illegal under UK law. And you can't get much more heinous than that, I don't think. And yet, when David and I decided to go public, he was the one that was put in prison twice. I was the one that was arrested. Our friends, family, supporters, and journalists were all arrested, and in some cases convicted for supporting him. And we literally had to go on the run around Europe as well. I mean, it was quite an intense time, because we knew we both faced prosecution under the Official Secrets Act, which makes any disclosure about this sort of thing a criminal offence, whether you're doing it in the public interest or not. So we had quite an intense few years of living in hiding in France, living in exile in Paris. As I said, David was sent to prison twice, first when the French didn't extradite him to the UK for trial, and then in 2002 after he'd come back voluntarily to stand trial. We were very, very careful not to damage national security. I mean, it was our job to assess what could, so we were very careful about that. But what we did feel very strongly about was if the spies were running around outside, out of control, there was no real accountability or oversight for them, they would continue to get away with murder. So we just felt that someone had to take a stand. But as you said right at the start, I mean, I look back now and think, what a mad thing to have done, you know. It was very, very sort of foolhardy, but it was done with the best of intentions. People tend to go into that sort of work to serve their country, and they still want to be of service, and if they think they can be of service by taking that stand and trying to expose crimes in the highest places, then they will. Well, it was pretty heavy duty. I mean, obviously there's the legal penalties of breaking the Official Secrets Act, so you face 2 years in prison for that. But also, of course, you go up against the establishment in this country, and they will ruin your reputation as well. So you're risking, of course, you lose your career, you're risking your freedom, and also you're risking your friends and family around you. So that's difficult as well. And it's very difficult to get work afterwards once you've blown the whistle. And in fact, David seems to have had some sort of breakdown since then, so he's paid a very, very steep price. We separated, sadly, a couple of years ago.
Now, in the book, David suggests Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed's death may have been orchestrated. That's a hell of a thing to come out with, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly a very pungent conspiracy. There's a whole range of conspiracy theories around the Diana death. But, again, it was a funny episode we got caught up in. It was when we were living in hiding in our farmhouse in France. And we had a call from our lawyer saying, Al-Fayed would like to speak to you, please. And it turned out that a well-known CIA and MI6 agent called Oswald Lewinter was trying to sell him some documents purporting to prove that those two organizations had been involved in murdering Diana. Now, these documents were very good forgeries, but they were forgeries. There were some very basic mistakes in them. So we turned around and said, well, no, actually, these aren't real. Don't buy them. And, of course, he had bought them and stood up and waved them in front of the world's media and said, look, I have proof. And they turned out to be forgeries. Nobody would have listened to him ever after. So I would say that there was certainly some sort of intelligence agency activity around that case. How far beyond that, we'll never know, I don't think. I mean, of course, we've had all these inquiries and inquests now, but I think most people are still suspicious about what happened that night. So I wrote a book called Spies, Lies and Whistleblowers, which I had to submit to MI5 and have cleared. But again, I was very careful not to damage national security, so there was very little they could try and take out. So I can talk now, because that's in the public domain, about all the meat of all the crimes we saw within MI5 and MI6. In terms of other stuff, like operations that actually went well, where they stopped stuff, then, you know, there's no public interest in disclosing that, so I wouldn't.
The other thing I want to ask you about is Dr. David Kelly, of course, because there were all sorts of rumours going around around that particular case. Is there anything you can add to that?
Not from the inside in any way, no. But, I mean, I know the MP, the Lib Dem MP, Norman Baker, has taken a strong interest in this case. And he's investigated it, and his conclusion was that it couldn't have been suicide in the way that we were told it was. Mm. And that goes for a number of very senior doctors as well. So again, you know, we've never had a proper inquest into a suspicious death in this country. What we have had, of course, was a ramped-up argument between the BBC and Andrew Gilligan and Alistair Campbell, the Labour spin doctor. And then we had the whitewash that became the Hutton Report and the Butler Report afterwards. So, of course, the government managed to sort of sidestep the issue of exactly how Kelly died. But I think it's very tragic. I mean, again, this guy thought he was doing something for the public good and paid the ultimate price. I mean, it's time we did need to reform the laws governing whistleblowers, certainly from within government and intelligence agencies in this country, because otherwise more and more principled people are going to come forward. They feel they have to do something about some egregious crime that they witness, but then they have to pay the price of at least losing their jobs, if not their lives. If you're talking about work within the areas of the intelligence agencies and government, of course, they are exempt from the Whistleblower Act in this country, completely exempt. So there is no protection whatsoever for a whistleblower from that area, and there's very little that any charity can do to support those people. This is why I would call for a wholesale re-evaluation of our laws. I mean, again, we saw the scandal around Damien Green, the MP who got arrested.
Yes.
And there was all this fuss about this chap, and, you know, my sympathies were with him. But very little has been said about the whistleblower. And he'd be the one, you know, if anything does go down in court, he would be the one going down. You know, he'll be facing the charges, not the MP. And he was the one who was trying to act in the public interest again.
How much in this country goes on without the public ever knowing about it, Anna?
Oh, a huge amount. I mean, journalists quite often will say, well, you know, even if we break a big story, we're still only scratching the surface, getting at 1% of what's going on. Mm. You know, and because a lot of this sort of work in the intelligence agencies and government is kept secret, there is no ventilation, no constructive criticism. So these sort of organizations become self-perpetuating oligarchies. They never reform. They never improve the way they work. And I have to say, if we really are up against this sort of global terror threat, we deserve the best protection from these sort of agencies, not some sort of half-assed, half-baked, old-fashioned way of working, which is what we've got at the moment. I mean, many, many of these senior managers and the spies, for example, grew up in the era of the Cold War when they were just investigating, you know, UK citizens for their political beliefs. And yet we're expecting them now to be fast-paced, evidence-gathering, FBI-style counter-terrorism officers. It doesn't work.
That was Annie Machen, who is an ex-MI5 officer. Now we have Chaos UK with Wall Street Crash. Difficult to find a more controversial academic and researcher than Nick Colostrum. after being part of a team of three people who, after the Falklands conflict in the 1980s, organised a people's inquiry into the sinking of the Argentinian warship Belgrano. He was one of the academics who revealed the Belgrano had been outside the zone set by the Royal Navy and sailing away from conflict when she was sunk. He was pilloried earlier this year by Nick Cohen in The Observer for allegedly being a Holocaust denier. But he's also revealed that the train police say the four alleged 7-7 London bombers caught from Luton to King's Cross was cancelled. Always courting controversy here on Dialect, we hear what he has to say and get him to answer Cohen's accusations of being a Holocaust denial. And Nick Collerstrom was thrown out of his job at University College London as a result. Anyway, he's bringing out a forthcoming book on the London bombings, and here he is now talking to Dialects at Tony Goslin.
My name's Nick Collerstrom, and when the 7-7 bombers went off, I was in the Science and Technology Studies Department at University College London, which was just a stone's throw away from Tavistock Square, OK? So I got drawn into this affair. I spent the day wandering around London. I'll always remember it, with all the tubes and buses off. And as a science historian, I feel I'm quite competent to get involved and look into this very technological computer type of crime. And I was a founder member of the 9/11 movement, which is to do with the idea of looking behind the scenes at a conspiracy and the idea that the Muslims who are made out to be guilty may not actually be the culprits. That's the basic core theme in the 9/11 movement. And I feel those issues equip me. And then I was down at Stockwell Tube, it's a thing about de Menzies, and I bumped into a couple of people who were getting the July the 7th movement going. And we sort of got on together. And I think that's a really good little group. And I did several pages for their wonderful website they've got on the July the 7th.
Yeah, but who are you, Nick, to do this kind of thing? I mean, I understand that you were involved, for example, with the Falklands War Inquiry and this kind of thing, this sort of activity.
Yeah, well, I'm involved as a peace activist in all my life, trying to ask the question, why is the hell does this country always go to war? Why do we always need a demonised enemy image? Can't we just live together without needing an enemy image? I think we all have to struggle with this issue of why this country always ends up going to war and finding out some new enemy. And I don't think this country needs an enemy, actually. I mean, we were angry enough with the Falklands War. We looked into the Belgrano Inquiry about how the Pearl Harbor ship, the Belgrano, was sunk in order to sink the peace plan, stop peace breaking out, so Britain could have the war that it wanted. And we had an inquiry about that, and we did a publication called The Unnecessary War.
You were involved in lead as well, weren't you? The effects of lead on the population.
Yeah, way back, I worked in the laboratory for the Medical Research Council, and it was advising the government way back in the early 80s that lead was from car exhaust was quite harmless and not hurting anyone. I looked into it, and I felt there were widespread ambient effects on stunting of child intelligence, and I did my first book called Lead on the Brain. It looked at the effect of ambient lead from paint, mainly from car exhausts, on intelligence and hyperactive, that is, antisocial behaviour.
Well, anyway, back to 7-7. Fast forward. And could you explain some of the latest research that you've been doing, some of the stuff you've found out, because you've got a forthcoming book coming out soon?
Yeah, right. I think it's very much thanks to the BBC, their conspiracy file. They kept taking me around the country to various places and asking me what things meant and what things added up to.
So you were being interviewed for a BBC documentary, BBC Two, I think, Conspiracy Files. Is that the case?
That's right, yeah. And especially they brought me along to the Kingston trial. Now, I ended up as the one, we might say, truth activist, or the one person known to be sceptical of the official government view of Muslims did it, who went regularly to this trial. And I heard...
This is the trial of the so-called 21-7 bombers. Is it?
No, not quite. It's three young lads who were friends, good friends, with the four alleged bombers. And they were put on a...
7-7, what?
Yeah. And they were put on a preposterous charge of conspiracy to cause explosions under a Victorian Explosive Substances Act law. And all that the prosecution could show was that they'd gone down to London for a couple of days and had a very enjoyable weekend and hadn't even visited a tube station, and they were alleged to be somehow preparing the plan. And the jury just was not convinced. So after 4 months' trial, we had a hung jury. But that did really give me insight into the latest retelling of the story. Because the story that keeps being, government keeps trying to retell, and each time they change it a bit. And it's those changes in the story that are quite important.
So what have you found out actually latest? What are your latest leads? Because I know that you're very keen to pick holes in the official version of events, and every now and again a fact comes up which actually means that a fissure, a crack, appears, and another crack appears. So what are the latest cracks?
Okay, let me tell you one thing which I think is quite recent, which I know you've been involved in, Tony. Daniel Albuquerque keeps retelling his story, okay? He's had a second version of his book, and twice he's had London meetings. Now, I'd like to hear psychologists checking over those. It seems to me that his memories have got integrity to them. Everyone who came up that bus had totally shattered fragmentary memories from extreme trauma, okay? And it's a question of trying to put together those shattered fragmented memories how coherent, how reliable are they? It seems to me that Daniel has actually got some reliable memories which he's actually wanting to tell us. And as people have said, he's better at oral testimony than the written word. I think that he's actually got some quite good memories, and those do include a whole lot of people hanging around that square in a prearranged manner just before the bomb went off. So a whole lot of people were somehow ready to cope with casualties and so on once the bomb had gone off. That's a definite part of his memory.
But there are many people who don't think that there's any problems with the official story on 7/7. One of the main reasons, of course, is that we see one of the alleged bombers actually making a video, a jihadi video. Many people have seen this, and I think that really makes very many people sceptical about whether the official story doesn't stand up, because that seems to justify everything.
Yeah, Khan, everyone who knew Khan in his life knew him as a young lad, totally committed to non-violence, a wonderfully gentle fellow who worked at a school helping kids with problems and skills in conflict resolution, really. And he did go to a sort of jihad-type outing in Pakistan, together with his friend, I think, Tanweer. And he might have gone because his father was terminally ill. I'd like to get details of exactly why he went. But there was some sort of film he made with his baby, and some sort of films released after his death. And
now, isn't that all evidence that he clearly was prepared to take a very militant and possibly armed stand against the Western powers for whatever reason?
Well, we'd really like to hear the testimony of his close relatives about that film and whether they believe it. I mean, I would say a whole lot of people have said that the lips moving don't seem to match up with the spoken voice, spoken word very well in that film. And The Guardian interviewed various people who knew him who said that they weren't very convinced by that video. I think we have to realise that voice morphing technology is quite advanced these days, and they certainly did have photographs or videos of him before his death, because he did work with the local police helping to get kids off drugs. He had quite a skill in getting kids off their heroin addiction.
So anyway, for you, what are the main, handful of problems that you have with the official version of events on 7/7?
Well, I think the central impossibility in their story has been the evolving idea of what was the explosive, okay? Within the first week of the event, we get a credible story of what's called C4, that's NATO's high-power military explosive, and that is connected with synchronised detonation, remote-controlled detonation, no suicide bombers. We get real experts telling us that in the first week. After that, it suddenly morphs to, some lads up in Leeds, they're brewing this up in a bath, and it's a totally different explosive, some gee-whiz explosive called TATP, that's all a bit new, and it involves mixing acetone, sulfuric acid, and hydrogen peroxide. and where these lads had no discernible interest in chemistry at all, but that was the story. For a whole year or 2 years, we're told about how they brought TATP down in their rucksacks in that little car and so forth and blew it up. And then at this Kingston trial, it changed again, as if they were fed up with trying to explain where they got this peroxide from and how they mixed it with strong sulfuric acid and stuff and in the bath. All sounded rather unlikely. So the very, very simple version. Oh, black pepper and peroxide. Wonderfully simple. Because after all, the 21-7 had been incriminated with chapati flour and peroxide, didn't they? But the thing is, those bombs didn't actually go off, whereas you got tremendous explosions on 7-7, which ripped apart whole tube trains. Black pepper and peroxide is just laughable. But that is their story. That really, really was the story at the Kingston trial. And alleged photographs were shown at this Alexander Grove so-called bomb factory, were alleged to be shown black pepper and peroxide. Now, once they've given out that story, they're not at liberty to change it again. I don't think they can change it again. They've had three changes, and this relies centrally on the amnesia and credulity of British journalists. I'm sorry to have to say that, but this ever-changing story of what the bomb chemicals were is only possible because of this degree of amnesia of British journalists, and each time it gets a bit less credible. First was a credible bomb, credible explosive, but had no suicide bombers, had remote detonation. And now, if somebody wants to claim those...
But hang on, Nick. Well, there was a police investigation that then took place, and that's when the involvement of the bombers was discovered afterwards. I mean, you wouldn't expect the involvement of suicide bombers to be discovered straight away.
Well, of course, I accept that. But all I'm saying is that the explosive used... alleged explosive keeps changing and it's got a bit less credible every time. That's what I'm saying. Their story now does not match up at all with the blast that actually took place.
Okay, so what other major holes? I know you were involved, for example, in the discovery of the train times being wrong. Yeah. But then, you know, it's very easy to say it was a specific train if it left roughly at the... It may have been a train that was timed at a different time that was late. You know, I think you... Surely, you know, you don't really have any evidence.
We got very clear data. This is the wonderful breakthrough made both from the King's Cross computer database and the Luton computer database about the trains, when they were supposed to come and when they actually come and how long it actually took to get there. And all the world has now had to accept those results, which we found a few weeks after the event, OK? The government has had to admit, after saying for a whole year that it was the 740 train, actually that 740 train didn't run. So that was a central error in that whole story.
But surely, you know, in any investigation there's going to be a few mistakes.
Well, they had given CCTV times both at Luton and at King's Cross Thameslink. And the simple fact is that the times they initially gave were not feasible, were feasible with normal train times, but the trains actually that morning were all delayed due to trouble with power lines, and you couldn't actually get between those two stations at the times they specified. Now, what happened a year after that they said somebody wasn't running, and then, get this, last summer, when they released what was supposed to be video, oh, at last they're releasing the video, 3 years later, all very, very blurred and, you know, generally lacking in timestamps. But they released this video of these lads coming to the Luton station, right? So this was the big moment. And that video had 7:22 when they descend down to the platform, okay? So they're on the platform, 7:22. They would have had to get the 7:25, okay? Which is the government's latest story. So this appeared shortly after government said, oh, well, of course, it's got 7:25. Now, if they had that CCTV picture, a big sequence, that was totally there and they'd had it all that time, how could they say to the whole, for a whole year, to all the world, oh, they've got the 7:40 train? If they had that CCTV timed in front of their noses, it's quite unthinkable.
Okay, so that's this. The train times business is one thing, but I mean, what about the lack of CCTV evidence? And this is something you've commented on, because most people who know think they know about 7-7 have seen those CCTV images.
Yeah, Well, this is a very shocking thing. The majority of Londoners believe they saw the four on the morning of July 7th at King's Cross in London. It's hard to tell them that actually what they saw was a showing of June 28th CCTV, when three of those lads really did come up to London, really did travel from Luton to King's Cross, and are really there. And that's clear, crystal clear, unfiddled CCTV pictures. You can see them. And they showed this, the BBC showed this a year after, on the anniversary, year anniversary, without the timestamps, taking out the date and time. Oh, fancy that. So we just get rerunning of June 28th as if that's the July the 7th four suspects. Now, that's a very shocking thing to do. But I think that until the trial last summer, so-called July 7th trial, there was no CCTV whatsoever of any of that lot in London. Now you've got apparent shots of Hassie people saying at King's Cross, and do you want to believe it? It all looks a bit sort of tampered with, and we'd like some expert opinion of this film that's been temporarily released. It's gone now, but they did temporarily release it over a few months during that trial.
Okay, also the privatisation of the Underground happened, I think it was 6 or 10 months before the July 7th attacks 2005. That meant, of course, that there were private companies then working all over the tube network.
Yes, indeed. This was something Red Ken tried to oppose, but he couldn't stop this privatisation. And Metrolink and Tube Lines were the two companies that divided up the running of the London Underground, and they hired this Israeli-based company, Verint Systems, which had sort of intelligence in the way it supposedly recognised what the maybe terrorists or whatever they're looking at in the CCTV pictures. We've had a hard job, as you know, persuading them to admit that they're using Verint. A whole lot of their spokesmen wouldn't admit it and didn't seem to know anything about Verint and got quite angry when we said, yes, you're using this Verint technology, which is actually the same as it was on the bus. The bus had also got some connection with Verint systems and their CCTV, which also that also clearly wasn't working on the day. All the bus CCTV was mysteriously blank. The bus company, Stagecoach, insisted it was perfectly okay when they gave it to the police. The police say, oh, no, there's nothing on this. It was dysfunctional.
And what about this chap Peter Power? Because, I mean, you've obviously looked quite deeply into him and, in fact, even had some communication with him.
Yeah, so I chatted with him in his Piccadilly office. He wouldn't quite grant me an interview, though. He has a very central... he's like Mr. Terror Drill for Britain, clearly he kind of got in a scary position of knowing a bit too much, a bit more than he wanted to. What he thought was just some sort of terror drill suddenly went real, and he had to sort of cover his arse, so to speak, and he did that by going going live on various TV programmes that day, saying what a shock it was for him that this thing suddenly happened at the very stations, the very time then he was doing the terror drill, and trying to make out that, this sort of thing just happens. And as you know, recently this year, he's come out and said he was doing this BBC TV programme that was supposed to show what the company was he allegedly was working for, Reed Elsevier. But it's not at all clear why that company, which is due with arms trade sales, would want to be... having any terror drill on London Drill? What the hell business is it of theirs?
So is there any evidence with this terror drill, so whether it was a kind of paper exercise in an office or a real exercise with real people out on the streets?
Yeah, I think there's about three different statements he made, and one of them does talk about microphones being used so people thought it was a real event. Later on, you see, later retellings, he tried to make out it was just a desktop exercise with people just staring at their computer screens. But I think there's enough in the initial telling of the story to indicate that it was somewhat live. And We point out that the terror drills they had before, like Exercise Atlantic Blue in April of that year, which was about bombs going up on the London Underground, an Anglo-American collaboration, the whole thing is to get as much happening live as possible. You want real people from every department of your government sort of seeing bodies being carried around and having the psychological experience of a live terror drill, which actually happens. I think we, the people of London, want a lot more detail about how live these ruddy terror drills are that are being going on in the tubes and so on.
Okay, and what about some of this the implications of what this means for civil liberties? Are you concerned about that?
Well, we've had a whole stack of anti-terror drills in the wake of this, which dissolve this central axiom of British justice, that the person is innocent until proved guilty. That's the terrible thing, and as we all know, that mainly applies to Muslims. You know, if you're not Muslim and you haven't got a beard, maybe you don't need to worry too much. This thing is racially predicated, and I think none of those laws were necessary. They're all bad laws. There was enough in the statutes to arrest people for crime without these horribly vague concepts that are being introduced now that enable you to be arrested if the police basically think you've got the wrong attitude, or somebody might put a CD through your door which might show something. I mean, frankly, Muslims in Britain now hardly know what it is they're supposed to do or not do to avoid getting arrested. You know, anyone a bit politically independent is in danger, and that might be the aim of the exercise.
So how do you think that 7-7 then, at least your reading of it and the problems that have come from a lack of an inquiry, how does that fit into the wider war on terror?
Well, it was essentially to stop this terrific forgiveness of debt with the G7 summit, the G8 summit was supposed to accomplish. If you remember all that stuff about make poverty history, there were terrific expectations, and the immediate aim of Bush and Blair meeting together and having this go off, and they talk about terror then, was to totally sideline and marginalise all the hopes of that G8 summit for forgiving the debt of Africa. That was, as it were, the immediate geopolitical effect. But it also had the geopolitical effect following on from the Madrid bombing, right? The jihad concept of this illusory, non-existent Islamic al-Qaeda doing these things, it arrived in Europe with the Madrid bombing, and it was then reinforced with the London bombing, so that all the media now can routinely use the concept of Islamic guilt as a totally presupposed thing. We've had no proper investigation, no rational inquiry. It's just prejudged and presupposed, and it enables wars to take place. I mean, none of us know whether the new war in Iran is going to happen, but it gives a ghastly ratification of these new wars.
Many people may certainly, you know, be interested in this. If people do feel like they want to find out more or do something about moving towards a resolution and a bit of closure around 7-7, have you got any advice for people?
Well, yeah, I'd say try to form a 9-11 truth group. I think 9-11 groups do discuss the July 7th story. Don't just mull it over by yourself. Don't just get upset by yourself. Form a group, and especially if you've got any Muslims who are politically active, express support for them so that they do get in trouble. Your group will help them out. And I think group activity here is very much the way forward.
But you see, people associating with Muslims in that way may be considered terrorists themselves.
Well, that is obviously what the establishment want you to believe. But we need to remember the fundamental concepts of law in this country. And I especially urge any women. Don't forget, there's about 16 times less women in jail than men in this country. It's hard to arrest a woman. And I think if any group has women prepared to be spokespersons and speak the important words of truth and righteousness, then that's enormously valuable for our society, keeping the civilised values intact.
Finally, you have been pilloried by Private Eye Nick Cohen and various other people as a Holocaust denier. Would you like to reply to them, your sort of right to reply to these accusations?
Well, I'm not sure I want to say a lot about it, but I basically got drawn into that area through chemical studies. Chemical studies about where cyanide was found in brickwork, in old chambers around Auschwitz, and there's certain places where it was not found, where it should have been found, and certain places where it was found, which have been very little discussed. And the places where it was found were what we call just delousing chambers, where the Zyklon was used for normal routine delousing purposes for protecting against typhus. I don't know if I went a bit too far in what I said, but I think this is a very interesting area where two different chemical researchers have found the same result, and I hope it becomes a more acceptable subject for civil discourse without people just everyone yelling at you, you know.
But I mean, obviously, people, Jewish people themselves and other people who are sympathetic to the Holocaust are going to be rather annoyed that you're actually saying that people weren't killed in this way, when, of course, the general orthodoxy is that they were. And also, you've got to have very strong evidence if you're making a claim like that.
Well, I had a letter published in the Jewish Chronicle saying that I wasn't denying the Holocaust. They did accept that, okay, that the terrible thing did happen to the Jewish people in World War II. So it was a memory of grave trauma for them. So, you know, they accepted that. So I don't think I'm denying anything personally, but I think I'm looking at chemical evidence in that situation.
Nick Collerstrom there answering claims by the Observer's Nick Cohen that he's a Holocaust denier. Well, I told you it would be controversial. And next up we have Led Zeppelin with Heartbreaker. That was Led Zeppelin with Heartbreaker. That is all for this Dialect Christmas special. Your studio engineer was Villis Chitakurin. I'm Jeff Sparks, and production was by Tony Goslin. There'll be another Christmas special next Tuesday, when we'll be hearing from more controversial people, and Dialect will be back to normal in the new year on the 13th of January. So have a good holiday, God bless, and goodbye until next week.